In the Voice of Russia World Service, we present the program Red Line.
Welcome to the Voice of Russia and its weekend program, The Red Line. Every weekend, we, Sergei Strokan, Mira Salganik, and Yekaterina Kudashkina, invite you to discuss the most significant events of the week. We are joined by Russian and international experts, politicians, scientists and artists, sharing or opposing our views on the vast and increasingly interdependent world shared by all of us.
We want our program to be personal, provocative and fair.
This week, we start with the events in Libya where a military standoff between Colonel Gaddafi and his loyalists and NATO-supported rebel forces reached its climax after 6 months of deadlock. We will then mark the 20th anniversary of another revolution, which is Russian Revolution of August 1991, which actually paved the way for the emergence of a newly independent Russian state.
And made our compatriots here to wake up in another democratic country, Katya.
Well, true. We will look at Mikhail Gorbachev, the first president of the USSR and a pioneer of glasnost and perestroika, remembering those events now. And finally, in our last heading, Facing the News, we shall talk about the North Korean leader Kim Jong-il, who this week paid another visit to Russia, the first one in more than a decade, to discuss the prospects of the six-party talks on North Korea nuclear program, along with ambitious multi-billion gas pipeline building projects, which, if implemented, might change the face of the Korean Peninsula and entire Far East region.
Katya, try to be more optimistic. To me, it is not if implemented, but when implemented, as what was proposed by President Medvedev is really a deal for North Korean strongmen, who, unlike Gaddafi, doesn't have oil and gas.
But wants to stay in power and is looking for a survival kit for the faltering state-run economy, desperate for energy and cash.
Well, Mira, it is not that simple, but economy definitely matters even for such rulers like North Korean, so to say, beloved leader. Economy doesn't obey strongman's orders like people do, be it Libya, be it North Korea or Belarus. And Comrade Kim has to find the way how to come to terms with free market realities of today's world.
Well, wait, Sergei. Sorry, colleagues. This is an interesting subject. We'll come to it later at our final heading. But now almost everything is overshadowed by Libya. So, beyond the headlines, this is our first heading in which we'll discuss the latest turnaround in Libya's ongoing revolution or battle or civil war. Call it whatever you like. Now, all our eyes are fixed on Tripoli, where opposition forces are still trying to suppress remaining pockets of resistance of Colonel Gaddafi's diehards, while Libya's strongman whereabouts are not known. Some say he's in one of the bunkers, others argue that he might already fled as far as Venezuela.
Well, Katya, wars produce a lot of rumors, a lot of paranoia. They produce not only big blood. And, you know, to be frank, at one point I'm getting mad when I dive into a flood of conflicting reports on Libya. It is extremely difficult to understand what is actually going on and who controls what.
But, Sergei, there is hardly war or no war. Any reason to believe that this time Muammar Gaddafi will be able to miraculously reverse the clock, don't you think so?
Oh yes, no doubt. To me, the latest developments in Tripoli look like a delayed though inevitable agony of Gaddafi's regime. And I realize that a lot of Colonel Gaddafi's secret and open admirers here in Russia, because there's a lot of people who are fascinated with his ruling, they will disagree till the very last moment. However, I see no way for him to regain control of the country. This is my point.
Well, regaining control is another issue. Possibly he's not going to regain control of the country. But I'm not sure that this is exactly the end of the story.
You're listening to Redline in the World Service of the Voice of Russia.
But anyway, President Obama already hailed rebels for what he called universal pursuit of dignity and freedom.
Well said, no doubt, but my question is what next? Can we expect that, so to say, dignity and freedom, to quote Obama, will prevail over Gaddafi's state-sponsored terrorism and oppression? Or will one utopia be replaced by another still more sinister, more inhuman?
Well, at any rate, the situation in Tripoli is shifting the focus from Gaddafi's past to nearing post-Gaddafi future, Sergei, you know? And I believe that that's what we need to focus on.
I was speaking about this news coverage of the events in Libya, you know, and I think that this flood of conflicting reports and TV images, which are changing with almost kaleidoscopic speed, gives you an overwhelming feeling of something already seen before.
Well, that's what Mira was referring to. That's the plain information war.
By this February, Gaddafi's, so to say, charm offensive at the West was over. And even the most blatant dictators like Gaddafi at one point lose sense of reality. This is actually what happened. And things finally came to the same end. Look what's going on. As in Iraq, foreign interference.
So foreign interference, which is absolutely unauthorized by international legislation.
Absolutely so.
That's one thing. The second thing I wanted to say is that I'm not sure that the end like this is going to play into the hands of the international coalition, because Gaddafi is going to be remembered like a true hero who resisted his enemy till the end. And do they really need such an icon?
I'm not quite sure, Kaza, that he will make this charming
I'm
icon.
Absolutely positive
Wait a sec. For a while, the image might persist, but then it depends on what would be the further development of Libya.
It's not exactly a version, but there's a widespread vision in Libya and around Libya that the latest developments, the developments of the past week, which, like Sergei rightly said, was preceded by 6 months of stalemate, were made possible due to a good old, simple, plain treason.
What do you mean, Katya?
Well, it's not me. It's not my theory, but I think I'm in favor of it. That's a recipe as old as the world. The enemies of Gaddafi simply bought some of his close associates. There was no resistance when the rebel forces entered Tripoli because commanders were already supporting the rebels.
Yes, you mean this episode when the rebels were entering Tripoli?
Yes.
Well, it certainly looks like there was somebody who opened the door. But I asked you what did you mean because I misunderstood you. I thought that you meant that the whole thing was machinated from outside, certainly.
No. I was referring to the events of the last week.
This one, yes. But on the other hand, don't you think that you may expect a number of other traitors coming up within a few hours?
Yes, of course. I don't think it's that uncommon in that part of the world, especially not mentioning the rest of the world.
Civil war is a horrible thing.
I guess so.
You know, Katya, you said that he might be an icon. I have my strong doubt over that. You are making too much emphasis on military aspects of operation, on treason, on the way how rebels came to Tripoli.
I'm awfully sorry, Sergei, but isn't it a military operation?
Look, my point is that regardless of whether NATO was there or not, I believe that at any rate, you know, regardless of what's going on to happen to him, whether he's captured, you know, or he's killed in action, under no conditions he will turn into an icon for tens of thousands of Libyans for simple reason that they're fed up with his ruling. This is one thing.
While a similar number still in love with him.
That's right.
Plus, Sergei, sorry to remind you, but you really ought to mention it. Libya is such a motley combination of tribes, of sects, of this and that, that unity should be at a premium there. And now there is a civil war almost started.
I think he will be to the liking of his first clan, obviously, and second to the narrow group of military elite whom he paid.
I'm quite positive that you are misinterpreting the situation on the ground. Because otherwise, if your assumption had been true, there would have been no 6 months of stalemate in Libya.
No, this kind
and of such resistance.
And this kind of resistance. Mm. Those people had no airplanes to fly, but they still managed to resist under NATO bombings. I'm so sorry, Sergei. I think your assumption is wrong.
Sorry to interrupt you. It certainly looks like Gaddafi has stored quite a lot of armaments there. So he was not having airplanes, but he was having something else and something else. But Sergei wanted to reply you. You mentioned something of the military whom he paid, whom he made important in things. Do you remember the old reports from Libya mentioning Colonel Gaddafi and Major Jalloud, right? Well, where is Major Jalloud now?
Sorry, colleagues, we can go on with this forever, but I think we should shift the focus
to the
post-war Libya, or rather to the post-Gaddafi Libya, because I'm not sure that the war is going to end with the fall of Gaddafi. But anyway, so will the so-called liberated Libya, where there was no land operation, escape the fate of liberated Iraq? Or is it heading to a dark age of chaos, clan, religious strife, Al-Qaeda operatives, the so-called Al-Qaeda operatives, turning it into their new homeland?
I think you're right, but let us agree that the future of post-Gaddafi Libya will be determined by several key factors. And first, obviously, a lot will depend on the new authorities, whoever comes to power, on their ability to quickly end the hostilities, to announce national reconciliation program. And a lot depends whether they will allow former Gaddafi loyalists, people who are still fighting in the streets now, to integrate into the new reality. Actually, it will be the first step to election and creation of a new legitimate government.
The goal is not at all unrealistic, though it's going to be extremely hard to achieve a kind of a consensus to create it. Not only is there is no unity between Gaddafi's loyalists and the opposition, but even within the opposition, there is going inevitably to be a kind of, may I say what I think, free-for-all.
By the way, Russia's President Dmitry Medvedev, while meeting North Korean leader Kim Jong-il this week, hinted that if the rebels have enough strength and opportunities to unite the country for a new democratic start, then naturally Russia will consider establishing relations with them. This week there was a lot of actually speculations, misinterpretations and distortions as to what would be Russia's policy towards New Libya and to what extent Moscow's interests will be affected.
Okay, so?
A section of international and regrettably Russian media was quick to announce that Moscow stands to lose a lot as winners, so to say, will not forgive Kremlin for not unequivocally recognizing the rebels' National Transitional Council. The way, say, France did at the early stage of the conflict. And some media outlets went even further by quoting certain Libyan sources as saying that Russia's leading oil and gas companies will be deprived of the right to secure their former position on the Libyan market.
Well, I'm sure there are some people who would like to see Moscow losing the position, but, you know,
it's yet
to be seen. I think this is sheer bullshit.
I don't know actually what brings such speculations to life. Is it a sheer ignorance or deliberate scheming? But I think it is time to recall that it is Russia's decision not to use its veto right in the UN Security Council while voting resolution 1973 this February that allowed NATO coalition to launch its campaign in Libya and probably save the lives of the current Libyan critics of Russia's position. If Russia just used its veto, there would be no any NATO operation in Libya. So let us not forget about that. And contrary to common belief, I think that by not taking sides in Libyan conflict, Moscow secured an important political victory.
What is it?
I think that by not taking sides in the conflict, Russia secured its future role as a mediator between Gaddafi's loyalists and opponents. The role Western powers can hardly take. And Russia can definitely facilitate inter-Libyan dialogue, though this will be an uphill battle, of course.
Well, should the sides fail, Tripoli of 2011 might really turn into Baghdad of 2003. So my question is, what are the conclusions that the international community should draw from the Libyan case?
This is the Voice of Russia. And now on Redline, an expert opinion.
We discussed this issue with Lieutenant General Gennady Evstafyev, expert in international security.
It appears that the Libyan game is almost over, and it gives us a chance to draw certain conclusions from what has happened in the last 4 months. And among those conclusions, there are some very important ones. The first conclusion is that the victory for the West in Libya became possible only by creating a very unnatural coalition between NATO and extremist Muslim forces and a small amount of liberals, which are very unnatural for Libya. So it clearly shows that when they are forced and they are in need, the NATO people can make deals with anybody, even with the devil, in order to promote their ends and achieve the necessary results. Second conclusion which we can draw from the situation is there is a brand new situation with the cyber attacks. Maybe for the first time in the recent history, we see tremendous amount of cyber attacks and disorganization of the internal life of the whole state. And the states which are not very developed must take note of this, because it appears that cyber attacks were extremely efficient and they really created very explosive situation in the country, especially when you have a multinational country and you have all kinds of local tribes and so on and so on. So you can induce certain people to start the movements, then you spread it with cyber and internet facilities, and then you are taking over quite a big amount, quite broad layers of local population. And this is quite clear, and the world will be very advised to think about this and to make certain decisions about the cyber attacks and the use of social nets for internal and unlawful purposes. By the way, I think the British should be very susceptible to this after those events which happened in London recently.
Mm-hmm.
The third conclusion is that the Democrats in NATO are quite capable of violating the international decisions. I mean the Security Council resolution, which allowed to establish no-fly zone over Libya, but they have interpreted this to the extent they made it NATO-only fly zone in Libya, and then they openly helped one party in the internal conflict and bombed the legally formed government of Gaddafi, whom I don't sympathize with, but we have to admit that only recently the Western countries dealt with him like officially recognized political force. And that means that when supporting certain UN resolutions, we have to think in broader terms and look more carefully into the possible consequences of supporting certain resolutions. And one more conclusion we can draw. The Libyan crisis on the surface is over, almost over, but we are only witnessing possible, unpredicted, unexpected development in the internal affairs of this country, because the amount of extremist organizations, including Al-Qaeda, in the ranks of Libyan opposition is very sufficient. And it's very interesting to see how West, who is stating that they are the enemies of Islamic extremists, how they're going to cope with the situation and what is going to happen there. In this sense, I believe that the position of Moscow as far as the other Islamic country of the Middle East concerned, Syria, is very much justified, because it is no use in these circumstances to support any UN resolution which allows the use of force, because we now see the way the resolution was interpreted by the NATO and the way it was used to crush the unpleasant regime. And we understand that there is not only the problem of atrocities. Nobody speaks about atrocities, though it was the reason why the resolution was taken. But it was now very clear that the war was for Libyan oil. And in this sense, it is the fifth conclusion. We have to watch carefully, because among the countries which suffered from this unprecedented use of force against the Libyan state is Russia, which lost about $4 billion of possible contracts with Libya. This is a situation which brings us to very calm conclusion that NATO has to be taken seriously as an organization that could not be really relied upon in certain situations, and we can't have confidence in this organization when it comes to their own interests.
But Mr. Evstafyev, how would you assess the rapid progress which actually came in only a week's time? Because just a week ago, everyone was saying that the Libyan opposition is so disunited that during the previous 6 months of NATO operation, they still failed to achieve any progress whatsoever. And now we see a rapid progress just in a week's time. Do you think that there could be some involvement from external forces, so to say?
I would make a point, and this point has a historic parallel. You must remember when Saddam Hussein was thrown out of power during the military operation, but open military operation by Americans, everybody was also surprised how fast it occurred. But there was no secret about that. Secret was in the first 3-4 days, but then it came out in open. It is betrayal, because the United States, the Western countries, they operate not only by military force, but mostly they operate by buying certain critical and crucial figures of the regime with which they fight, and giving them money and allowing them this money to be spread about their subordinates. And I am sure that in this particular case, there was a tremendous amount of money thrown into the last week's operations, through which they managed to buy a number of crucial military people in Gaddafi's military establishment. And the third reason was that they have intensified the bombardments, and there is a suspicion that NATO units took direct part in attacking the vital installations of Gaddafi regime. But one has to draw parallels between Saddam Hussein and Gaddafi. Let me tell you that it is not spoken very loudly about, but there was a very influential military leader in Saddam Hussein's regime who was famous for his atrocities against Kurds and Shiites. And then he suddenly left the Saddam Hussein's regime and escaped abroad. And he landed in Denmark. But in Denmark, he was taken under house arrest. He was allowed to live in Denmark, but was not allowed to leave the country under no circumstances. Just about 1 month before Saddam Hussein was crushed, this man disappeared from Denmark, and Danish officials were saying, well, we don't know how did it happen, and all this kind of funny explanations. But this man disappeared, and he was taken by Americans, and he was the instrument through whom the Americans have bought a number of crucial Iraqi military people who betrayed Saddam Hussein. I'm sure that the same thing happened here.
Mr. Evstafyev, thank you very much. And just to remind you, our guest speaker was Lieutenant General Gennady Evstafyev, expert in international security issues.
This is the Voice of Russia.
This is Red Line. Well, and now I suggest we might move to our next section, which is Between the Lines, in which we usually discuss what we believe to be a most noteworthy newspaper story of the week. And this time, it's an article by Mikhail Gorbachev, the former and the only Soviet president, entitled Lessons from the USSR Coup Attempt, and published by the Washington Post. This piece is his recollection of the coup dating back to the 19th of August 1991, which is also known as the August Putsch, and another attempt by the former Soviet leader to explain what happened 20 years ago.
That should be really a tough job, Katya. People tend to forget, and besides, even now, the whole story is quite confusing.
But, Sergei, just let's follow the red line tradition. Just first let me quote the story. 20 years ago, Mr. Gorbachev is writing, a group of Communist Party Politburo members and Soviet government officials attempted a coup d'etat. They created an unconstitutional committee on the state of emergency, isolated the Soviet president, and removed him from power. The events of that August were the result of fierce political struggle during the final stretch in our efforts to reform the Soviet Union. Admittedly, we, leaders of Perestroika, made our share of mistakes. We acted too late to reform the Communist Party, which became a brake on Perestroika instead of being its engine. Its bodies launched an attack on me as its general secretary that reached its peak at the party's central committee meeting in April 1991. The attack became so vicious that I announced my resignation.
It's an absolutely tragic story, compressed into a few paragraphs.
Well, that's what history is all about.
Yes, I guess so.
But before we proceed, I suppose we need to remind our listeners just very briefly what we are talking about. So, 20 years ago, the self-proclaimed State Committee for the State of Emergency, which is GKCHP in Russian, attempted to seize power in the Soviet Union. So, the formation of the GKCHP was officially announced on the 19th of August, and Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev and his family were isolated in their residence in the Crimea. Troops were sent to Moscow, opposition parties, movements, and newspapers were banned, but then President of the Russian Federation Boris Yeltsin and other republic leaders took the initiative in their hands, and Yeltsin issued several decrees which qualified the GKCHP as a coup attempt and took over the control of the Union government, including the law enforcement agencies. So the GKCHP was disbanded on the 22nd of August and its members were arrested. So that's the same tragic story in one paragraph.
But Katya, getting back to the story, did Mr. Gorbachev share any of his personal recollections? Just how it happened to him and his family?
Oh yes. At the time they were on a brief vacation in the Crimea, like we said. He's writing, I was burnt out from months of tough battles, but I underestimated the resistance of reactionary forces. I should have postponed my vacation. So on the 18th of August, I spoke by phone with my assistants and with Yeltsin to finalize details of the treaty ceremony. That's a very interesting detail. I was planning to fly to Moscow on the 19th of August, Mr. Gorbachev writes, to attend the signing, but an uninvited group showed up at my residence. Minutes before the delegation of the coup plotters arrived, all my phones, the city line, official telephones, and the strategic communications line went dead. I was totally isolated. It became clear that my opponents in the Politburo and the government had chosen the path of a coup d'etat. I told my family that the situation posed grave dangers to our country and ourselves, and that I did not know how things might end. I said that I would not agree to any collusion with those people, and my wife Raisa and our family said that they would stand by me come what may. The delegation demanded that I temporarily cede my powers to Vice President Gennady Yanayev or resign. I categorically refused and demanded a convening of the Congress of People's Deputies or a session of the Supreme Soviet. So this is a first-hand account of what was happening on the day. And those are personal memories of the coup of the then president of the USSR, but I'm sure each of you has your own personal memories of GKCHP. Just do you think you could share them with us too, Mira?
I don't think that my personal memories are worth describing at all. But I wanted to say that, yes, of course, 20 years seems to be a long time for my country. Yes, of course, the memories are blurred and things have changed. But there is one thing which remains alive, and that's a lot of animosity towards Gorbachev. And one of the sort of the causes of this animosity is that he's always accused of subscribing to breaking up of the Soviet Union. While the contrary is true, just now when you've read his sort of, you know,
memories,
his autobiographical account, you may call it or not, He says that the telephones were switched off at the moment when the Union Treaty, which was to secure the Soviet Union in the changing reality, has been ready to sign. It was not him that was thinking of dismantling of the Soviet Union. The contrary is true.
In the Voice of Russia World Service, we present the program Red Line.
But anyway, look, it took the GKCP only 60 hours.
Exactly.
I mean, the suffering was rather short. But getting back to Mr. Gorbachev, so it's interesting. Ironically, the man who came to his rescue appeared to be Boris Yeltsin. And by the way, that's how Gorbachev himself is describing it. My reply to the coup plotters dealt the first blow to their plans. Equally important was the fact that they were unable to intimidate the people. Our society had learned to resist, to protest and make demands. President Yeltsin took a strong stand, condemning the putsch and calling the actions of the plotters a coup d'etat. I appreciated and praised Yeltsin's actions during those days. So that's the recollections of our first president.
Oh, yes, there were protesters. There were protesters. There were masses of protesters. I saw the figures. They said there were about 50,000 people assembled around the White House to protest against the coup d'etat GKCP. And incidentally, everybody was expected an assault.
We all had high hopes, all of us, whether someone has gone to the White House or not. And the dominant feeling was that we have just to stand up to protect the democratic reform started by Gorbachev. And really, that was incredibly good time. You know, the media was suddenly open to all sort of debate. And Communist Party administration was replaced by elected governing bodies. New parties appeared. No one wanted to lose that freedom.
But it's interesting. Remember we started with saying that people tend to forget. Well, a term of 20 years is roughly a generation. And according to the Levada Center latest poll, only 10% of respondents said that the suppression of the August putsch in 1991 was a victory of the democratic forces, which put an end to the rule of the Soviet Communist Party. Only 10%, mind you.
Katya, but look here, let me give you a piece of statistics. According to what Gorbachev said in radio interview recently, there was another opinion poll and people were asked whether they regret the disintegration of the Soviet Union. Overwhelming majority said yes.
They regret it.
Yes.
But that coincides with those figures.
Yes, and no wonder too. In the years that followed, living standards went down drastically. That's enough for many people to be unhappy. But that's one aspect, I feel. I wanted to say that it was not really a demand for democracy. It was a protest of what the Soviet Union was before Gorbachev, of that, you know, sort of suffocating oppression. And I would like to add another thing. As for the what we call national republics, now the independent states, the number one on their agendas was not democracy. National freedom, the national culture, the national language, national everything. And there was a clash of the two later on.
Mira, but let us not forget about the pitfalls of the democratic process also. And let us say that in the years that followed, people lost their savings to market reforms. There was hyperinflation, prices on basic goods were freed. And I remember in some of the Western media outlets, there was a headline about Gorbachev, good talk, no goods.
Good talk, no goods. That's
yes,
a good one.
Yes, I remember that one. But I wanted to add another thing. I'm talking too much today, but please. I want to say that there were two myths that were sort of, you know, acting on people's minds. One was, do allow us democracy, and things will take care of themselves. The second myth, as dangerous, as false as the first one, the myths are false, the free market will regulate everything. Democracy cannot be allowed It should be established, first of all, in people's minds. Secondly, free markets are not a key to everything.
Yes, and I also think that there was some misconception of democracy. Democracy is not irresponsibility. Responsibility is really a burden. And I'm not sure that all of those who demanded democracy were prepared to carry the burden of democracy.
I fully agree with you, Katya, but I would like to remind you that in the Soviet Union, the question of responsibility did not arise in people's mind. It was the state
who took on the
responsibility.
It's like something like spoiling a child. If you take on the responsibility for whatever,
he grows up irresponsible.
He grows up infantile.
Infantile, of course. But look, the state took full responsibility for all of us, for all the three of us here, from the moment that we
were born
till we were buried.
We have not been buried as yet, but
not
anyway.
Not yet. Not we, not the people specifically in this room. But there was no question of responsibility. Your responsibility was to follow
instructions
from above. That also is producing its results up till now.
Well, but anyway, just like we say, reality is more complex than it seems, you know.
Sure.
And now I suggest we might listen to someone who is both the witness and the researcher into the 1991 coup. And so please meet Dmitry Babich, a political observer for RIA Novosti News Agency.
This is Redline, coming to you in the World Service of the Voice of Russia.
Mr. Babich, I saw your very interesting piece in the RIA Novosti website. And I was just curious to know, as far as I understand, you made quite a substantial research into the issue.
Well, that's only partially true, because when the events happened in August 1991, I was a journalist in Komsomolskaya Pravda, which was the biggest newspaper at the time. But I was still pretty young. I was 20. And I just went to the White House. I saw what was going on around it. And then in the following 10 years, I took interviews from almost all the members of GKCP, you know, that Committee on Emergency, which was indeed behind the events that were presented as a coup, but which were partially a coup and partially something else, as I found out later.
What do you mean by that, partially a coup and partially something else? What is it, the something else?
Well, I would say that obviously Mikhail Gorbachev, the president of the Soviet Union at the moment, knew that something was going to happen, and probably he even knew about the plan.
Oh, really?
Of the of the GKCP. In fact, almost all of them were very close to him. He was in contact with them, and when they came to visit him on the eve of the coup, he told them in Russian, "Shut s vami valyayte," which means something like "To hell with you, try it." And he didn't deny it. So obviously the situation was more complicated than just a bunch of old communists trying to take power and a nice Democrat isolated and fighting back with people supporting democracy in Moscow. I would say that the real story was a bit more complicated. The Soviet Union was already almost dead at the moment. The Union Treaty that was planned to be signed, this Union Treaty was going to be signed by only 8 republics out of 18, at best, probably less. So, in fact, it was the last attempt of the outgoing Soviet bureaucracy to retake the power, that has already slipped out of their hands. But that doesn't say that Gorbachev was not a Democrat. I think he was a Democrat. And he is not an ideal person. Yes, he also thought about his own security, about his career, about his family. That's quite natural. He was not an angel or a hero. And also what happened, certainly I don't want to say that the people who came to the White House to defend the first elected Russian president, Boris Yeltsin, I think these people were sincere, and I was among them.
But what could be Gorbachev's interest in that coup?
Well, he was losing power. Together with all the Soviet authorities, he was losing power. Obviously, the Union Treaty, if it was signed one day later, according to the treaty, the Union was not going to get its own taxes. The republics, now 15 independent states, they were supposed to collect all their taxes on their territories and then to pass what was due to the center. And, any pragmatic statesman understands that such a state cannot exist for a long time. But in fact, power has been slipping out of Gorbachev's hands for many months before that. Already in 1990, the Communist Party was declared just one of the parties, not the center of the system. Already during the famous referenda of March 17, 1991, you know, to which the coup organizers tied their move, the legal foundation for that move, if you want. In that referendum, only 9 republics took part. So basically, you know, the power was already out of reach of Mr. Gorbachev. The world did not realize it, and many Soviet people did not realize it, because psychologically we still lived in the Soviet Union. But in fact, the Soviet Union had died at least several months before it died officially, in the end of 1991.
But then Mr. Gorbachev still quit after the coup.
Yeah, if you analyze his behavior, he returned, but he returned no longer a real president. Instead of joining the crowd and celebrating with them, he immediately went to his dacha. And in the following months, he talked as if he was the president. But in fact, I remember I worked at the newspaper at the time, we no longer paid too much attention to him. All attention was on Yeltsin, on the new Russian authorities. We knew that taxes were cut to the federal authorities. So basically, the Soviet authorities did not end with a revolution or something. They were just withered out without the money.
So which means that Mr. Gorbachev obviously lost to Yeltsin.
Well, I would say that, in fact, I think it was a part of a bigger scheme of a longer process. I'm no fan of conspiracy theories, but the situation was the following. If you look at what was going on in the Soviet Union in the end of the 80s, you know, there were the Russian or the Soviet elite, relatively young party apparatchiks, active, cruel, you know, cunning. And what did they get for all their effort? They got, okay, 3 or 4 room apartments, outdated cars that were made in Western Europe, you know, 30 or 40 years ago. Okay, maybe one trip abroad once in 2 years, once in 3 years, and that's it. They thought that they deserved better. They wanted to live like Arab sheikhs. And now they live like Arab sheikhs. And the whole story was that this elite gradually changed the system, allowing more leeway for itself. And the abandonment of the Soviet Union was part of that scheme, because it was just easier to accede to all of these new resources without the Soviet Union than with the Soviet Union. And if you look how the groups that gained most from the collapse of the Soviet Union, these are the elites of the former Soviet republics, now the ruling elites in the new independent states. Suddenly, you know, Kazakh government, which was just, you know, subdivision of the Soviet government, now it's a sovereign state, you know, the president going everywhere, his sons and sons-in-laws, you know, his daughters and sons-in-laws, billionaires. So now these are real elites who have real clutch on their resources. And that was the real driving force behind the events that took place then.
Dmitry, but moving on to just to people in the street, you said that you were one of the crowd in front of the White House. What was the sentiment?
Well, I remember that when I came there on the night of the first day, 19th of August, I met there my friend who was planning to go to study to the United States just several days afterwards. And he was in despair because he thought that he would not be able to buy an air ticket now, or he would not be given a visa to go to the United States. At the time, as I remember, we still needed some kind of authorization to go. So there were some people who were just fighting for their personal future, if you want. And there were others who were afraid of returning to the early 80s. And there were just some other people who were just hungry and who thought that things were just going, getting out of hand, and who wanted more reforms in the economy, and they tied their hopes to Yeltsin. There were all kinds of people there. On the other hand, just next to the White House, I remember we were driving with another correspondent of our newspaper, we were driving to the White House in a car, and we saw huge lines for vodka, you know, standing just maybe a mile or half a mile. away from the White House.
Meaning vodka was distributed?
Well, it was sold at the time, but it was very difficult to buy it.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to stand in a long line. So there were people who were desperate to defend the White House, and there were other people who wanted to buy vodka and to get by, you know, for them it was just a regular day. For the majority of the population of the Soviet Union, I mean, if you went out of Moscow and went to some other town or city, you would not see any kind of commotion on the street. Basically, it was a dramatic event, but the whole drama was concentrated in the corridors of power. You know, the officials were desperately deciding what they were going to do. And the elite was split. Part of the elite realized that the Soviet Union was going to collapse, so it was ready to join the winners to participate in the division of the spoils. And there was a part, you know, the old elite, who were basically represented by GKCP, who just didn't realize in time that the Soviet Union was going to be abandoned. Later on, this elite made up the Communist Party of Russia and their positions in the new independent states. Now almost all of it is co-opted into the new elite. They got their share of the spoils. And now they are part of the system. You know, some of the people who were clearly behind the GKCP in 1991, one of them is a regional leader now. Another one was a regional leader. He quit about 3 years ago. But, you know, almost all of them became part of the system. And I don't think that's very bad, because for the first time in Russian history, there was no revenge. You know, you may say lots of bad things about Yeltsin, but he was not a vengeful person.
No. But anyway, do you feel that the aspirations of that crowd in front of the White House, were they met during the years, over the years?
Well, I think the majority, of course, didn't get their aspirations fulfilled. I mean, that friend of mine went to the United States, okay, and he studied there for 3 months, and now he works with a huge Western new agency. He even managed to get a position outside Russia, a very rare event for anyone working for a foreign media, because, you know, I don't know what the situation is now, but in the 90s, when almost all my friends worked for foreign media, including me, we had a very clear ceiling, you know, how much we could achieve working for foreigners. And obviously, this ceiling was not very high. But he managed to get by, okay. But the majority, I think, they wanted just a more fair society. They wanted more social justice. And certainly, they didn't want oligarchic capitalism. And certainly they wanted free elections, but not only free elections, but also more democracy in the companies, more democracy in daily life. Unfortunately, 90% of these aspirations never realized.
Thank you very much. And just to remind you, this time our guest speaker was Dmitry Babich, Russian journalist, observer with the RIA Novosti Information Agency.
You're tuned to the Voice of Russia.
This is Red Line. And now I suggest we might move on to our final section, Man in the News. This time it's North Korea's leader Kim Jong-il, who was visiting Russia for the first time in some 10 years.
Well, Katya, Russia is one of the most countries he'd visited as part of his recent program aimed at expanding North Korean diplomatic ties. And it's been almost isolated, and besides, sanctions start to bite.
Well, did he arrive to ask for help?
I think rather for political and diplomatic support.
This is more polite. But sanctions were there for a number of years, and up till now, up till very recently, North Korea was acting quite aggressively, both in word and in deed. Do you have any idea what is the reason of the recent change?
Well, Mira, there's also an issue of succession which we have to keep in mind. And Kim is anxious to convince Russian leaders that his third son, Kim Jong-un, is strong enough to rule. And that could explain why he finally decided to take his armored train to Russia, like he did back in 2001. So this is the first visit after a decade.
Well, Stratfor analysts say that Kim Jong-il is preparing the country for the so-called Juche 100 celebrations. So those celebrations are going to begin with Kim Jong-il's 17th birthday in February, and then in April they're going to mark the 100th anniversary of his father Kim Il-sung, who died in 1994. So one of the elements in that is trying to find a way to strengthen the North Korean economic system, creating pockets of economic activity that can increase the amount of money to the country. And they also want to find a way to end the Korean War, by the way, which is not officially ended yet, to have a peace accord with the United States, and ultimately to have diplomatic relations with the United States. This is the vision of the Stratfor. So in other words, they're trying to improve investment climate, and they need to make at least some progress ahead of those celebrations. That is simple.
That's right, Katya. So that explains why they had been negotiating with South Koreans, with the United States, with Russia, and they have been obviously talking to China also.
Oh, the Chinese, but they never stopped talking to the Chinese. Kim Jong-il visited China 6 times over the past decade.
Yes, Katya, and perhaps there's another reason to his new openness to the world. He might be looking for ways to reduce the North Korean dependence on China. Economic dependence, too.
Are you referring to the gas pipeline deal?
Well, Mira, they have only been first negotiations so far, and nothing has yet been decided or finalized. You still need to discuss it with the South Koreans. This is an important thing.
But he still needs aid to support the country's economy. But getting back to where we started, Sergei, you know, the general notion that North Korea is a country inhabited with hungry people dressed in shabby clothes appeared to be outdated. I recently ran into a story by Andrei Lankov, who is an associate professor at Kookmin University in Seoul. And it's a story about, just guess who, the North Korean new rich.
That's a no.
Yes.
Do you mean the people who are having 3 meals a day against the regulatory 1.5?
Yes, that's right. His basic point is that in the past 20 years, there was a slow motion collapse of a hyper-centralized economy that was once a defining feature of North Korea's nationalist Stalinism.
Incredible.
But that's how it is. I knew you would be surprised. Grassroots capitalism, he says, has replaced state socialism, and this quiet transformation predictably brought in a remarkable income inequality. And now North Korea's new rich made their fortunes amid the economic chaos and social disruption of the Great Famine of 1996-1999. And this new bourgeoisie, so to say, matured in the next decade as the North Korean economy started to partially recover from the disastrous 1990s. And this is the first-hand information.
You mean to say a new middle class? But they may pose danger for the Kim dynasty.
Not necessarily, because the revolution, according to Lankov, would bring on the unification with South Korea, and that is something the new rich would try to avoid, for a simple reason that, in that case, they would lose their businesses to stronger competitors from South Korea. But anyway, that might improve the country's economic standing, and that in its turn is something that could secure the position of the Kim clan.
And also, don't forget, there is also this six-party talks on nuclear problems.
That's right. Kim said Pyongyang was prepared to restart the talks without preconditions. But in fact, he already told that to the U.S. and South Korea and other negotiating partners. So it still remains to be seen whether other parties would like to resume those talks.
Well, Katya, the format doesn't look to be particularly efficient. And then remember, there was a missile test in 2009. And then in 2010, there was the sinking of the South Korean warship and a lot of rhetoric and a lot of muscle flexing. And now, the sudden turn. Memories are still lingering.
Well, I heard an interesting account that might explain the turn. As you probably know, at the end of May this year, Kim Jong-il visited China, third time over a year. And usually during his travels, Kim Jong-il stays one night in each city he visits. This time, he traveled 3,000 kilometers for 3 days and 2 nights in his armored train to a small Chinese city of Yangzhou. And there were all sorts of speculations just why would he do that. But our South Korean colleagues, journalists, really suspect that Kim went to Yangzhou, which is the hometown of Jiang Zemin, by the way, who is Hu Jintao's predecessor and still a very influential Chinese politician, to meet with Jiang, which actually gives an impression that Kim seemed to have been seeking Jiang's support in matters pertaining to economy, politics, succession, and eventually the decision-making. Well, and with this we end this edition of Redline, brought to you by the Voice of Russia radio station. It was presented by Sergei Strokin and Miroslav Ganik, its founders, and myself, Ekaterina Kudashkina. Thank you very much for staying with us. Goodbye, and take care.
Take care and goodbye.
So long.
Redline has come to you in the World Service of the Voice of Russia.